This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
You've got to recreate that idea of being British, not because it's nationalistic or because it's better than anybody else, but because we all live in these islands together under one constitution, under one monarchy, under one flag, under one government, and we've got to make it work.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In a week that a town centre redevelopment got a shake-up, Medway Council dodged a bullet yet again, and a new MP has been having a verbal sparring match with his local council. I'm Daniel Esson, the local Moxie reporter covering borough and district councils in Kent. Simon, who usually covers the county council, and Rob, who looks after Medway, are both away this week, so instead I'm joined by KM Group news editor Sean Delaney.
Hello.
And KM Group senior news editor Nikki White remains at her post and joins us as well.
Hello.
And later on, we'll hear from a very special guest, the current commentator and former leader of UKIP, Henry Bolton. First up, Sean, what's been going on in Medway?
Well, last week was a fairly bad week for Medway Labour. This week, there's a little bit better news. Last year and this year, there's been doubts about whether the council will be able to form a fully funded budget, being reliant on exceptional financial support from the government, without which they'd have to file a Section 114 for bankruptcy. While there was uncertainty last year whether the council would get the additional funding from the government, this year, council officers are very confident the government will give them the extra £18.5 million they need for next financial year, which in itself is a good news, since the council originally predicted it would need £26.2 million.
Well, that sounds all right, but I'm guessing it's not all good news for them.
Well, unfortunately not. Firstly, the council were rejected when they applied to increase council tax above the limit of 4.99% without having to have a referendum. They wanted a further 5% increase. While it certainly would have been unpopular, officers said it would have sorted out the financial situation in 1 year and would have meant they wouldn't have needed to get the exceptional financial support from the government. The other bit of news, which is mixed positive and negative, is in order to make cuts to council services again, as has been done in some areas last year, charges for parking across Medway and the prices of some leisure facilities will be increasing. Parking is set to increase by 60p for both on and off street parking, and monthly family memberships for sports centres will increase from £81.25 to £87.75. The move has received mixed responses again, some people saying it's piling more charges on top of the public during a cost of living crisis, while others say it's a better option than more cuts.
Rough times to be a regular swimmer in Medway, I guess. Thanks very much, Sean.
So, Dan, what have the district councils been up to?
So I've been looking at Sevenoaks District Council's long plan to redevelop a huge area of land just to the east of its high street, but in the past week or so, they've announced some pretty major changes to it, which I've been trying to cover.
What were they planning to do and why has it changed?
So this £120 million project was set to include new homes, new library, new leisure centre, a market hall, hotel, footpath, loads of other stuff. Most of that is still there, but the library is instead going to stay in the existing Kaleidoscope building and the hotel has been removed from the plans entirely.
Why keep the library then if moving it was originally on the cards?
Basically, it's because Kent County Council have pulled out and they're the ones responsible for running library buildings and finding new ones. They wouldn't tell me in very much detail why they did that. They just said that they couldn't come to a mutually viable arrangement with the district council. I would have assumed it's financial, but the district council tell me the scheme should be self-funding because there's going to be 250 or 300 to 350 homes there, which will generate money from the council.
Are there any timescales for this? Is this going to be happening anytime soon?
Soonish. So Sevenoaks District Council need to debate and discuss the plans at meetings in the coming month. But in April, they're going to vote on putting the contract out to tender. I'd be surprised if much changes between now and then. So if all goes well, they'll have a private developer to help them out appointed by the end of the year, and then they'll have all of 2026 to start working on detailed designs and put in a proper planning application. But how long that could take once it's in is anyone's guess. So, Nikki, what's been going on at Westminster this week?
Well, we love nothing more than a war of words in politics. Debate is what it's all about, after all. And this week, it's the Swale Independents on Swale Council, and Labour MP for Sittingbourne and Sheppey, Kevin McKenna, who have been at loggerheads. Swale councillors were facing tough decisions this week when they met to thrash out the authority's spending plan for the next financial year. Like all local authorities, budgets are being squeezed more than ever before, and Swale have said it was going to look to save money by making £100,000 £64,000 in cuts to the playground budget, £64,000 in staffing changes, £36,000 of savings by axing funding for projects to tackle things like loneliness, and £47,000 in grants which councillors have traditionally given to the smaller projects on their patch. But as well as having to find savings for the day-to-day things, a 12-week public inquiry is due to start on March the 11th, and that's over two plans to build 8,400 homes, which is going to be to the south and east of Sittingbourne on a development called Highstead Park. That's a proposal that's gone in. The scheme would include a hotel, a new tip, both a primary school and a secondary school, a new M2 motorway junction, and the completion of a southern relief road. The council is against the plan, which has been put in by Quinn Estates, and has set aside what has been described by one councillor as an astronomical amount of money to pay for legal support with this inquiry. The specific sum itself hasn't been revealed, but it's understood to run into hundreds of thousands of pounds, possibly as much as £700,000. Now, we're recording this podcast ahead of the budget meeting, but the council's planning budget was set to balloon by more than £1 million. In comparison, their budget for 2024-25 was £409,000. Now, it's not clear how much of it will actually go on the Highstead Park battle, but it's not going to come cheap. And it's that battle which has led to a war of words between Mr McKenna and the Swale Independents.
So what's happened?
Well, the inquiry came about after Mr McKenna himself wrote to Housing Secretary Angela Rayner, and he asked her to take the decision out of the council's hands and let an independent planning inspector rule over it instead. Now, that's infuriated several people, including Swale Independent Councillor Monique Bonney, and she's described the move as galling and said the fact that the council was now having to shell out for these additional costs rested solely with Mr McKenna. Now, Mr McKenna has hit back, as you might guess he would. He says that their claim is just simply laughable, and he can't believe that they're trying to pull the wool over residents' eyes. He says he wasn't the only one asking for the Highstead application to be called in. He reckons there's dozens of local residents, businesses and community groups who are doing the same thing. And even if it hadn't been called in, there would have been an enormous cost to Swale anyway, because they would have turned the application down and then the developer would have appealed. He said people wanted an independent assessment of the developer's plans, and that would give guarantees that infrastructure would be built as well as the homes. Now, Mr McKenna said that he added his voice to those requests because he believes it's the best way to guarantee the development will bring the new bypass that Sittingbourne needs, as well as the schools and a health centre, which is what people are always calling for. He said it was the council's choice to spend £700,000 of council tax money to fight the planning inquiry and make the cuts to council services to find that money. He feels Swale could have been just as well represented at the hearings for considerably less. Now, we've got a few weeks to go before the planning inquiry starts, but it's not a row that's going to disappear anytime soon, so watch this space.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
I'm joined now by one of few men whose political career has taken them from the Yugoslav wars to UKIP. Henry Bolton cut his teeth in the army and police in Britain and the Balkans before coming back to this country to rise through the ranks of UKIP and end up its second leader after Nigel Farage. He joins me now in the studio. Henry, thanks very much for coming along.
Hi, Dan.
How are you doing today?
Oh, not too bad, thank you.
Firstly, just so people know, I haven't just brought on a random former party leader. You do, in fact, live in Kent. Would you tell me how it was you came to live in Kent and what do you like about
it? Whilst I was over in Afghanistan, I was mulling things over, and I thought, this has got to be my last war. I'm getting a bit long in the tooth. Time to go and settle down and find a proper base. I was brought up really in Berkshire for most of my sort of childhood before I joined the army. Been abroad so many years, and I came back and was looking for somewhere to on leave and looking for somewhere to live. Did a bit of research. Berkshire's far too expensive, but Kent sort of came onto the radar because as a child I used to spend school holidays down in Folkestone. My great uncle retired there, and he'd got to know it. He was from Yorkshire, but he'd got to know it because he was an officer in World War One. And he'd spent, you know, a few months, 3-5 months or so, billeted in Folkestone during World War One, and had travelled through there many times during the war because it was the main point of embarkation for troops. And when he retired, you know, he'd very fond memories of the place, had a lot of colleagues who'd settled down there. When he retired, he and his wife settled down there, and we used to go and visit him at the seaside during school holidays. So that was on my radar, fond memories of that, fond memories of Kent. So I thought, okay, can't afford Berkshire, next place to go, Kent.
Like you mentioned, obviously, you were at one point in Afghanistan and in various other places. Obviously, it's quite a long story, but do you mind giving, for the sake of listeners, a sort of brief summary of your life and career and how specifically how you ended up coming back to Britain and joining and then leading, you know, UKIP?
I can almost blame my great uncle. At a very tender age, partly probably due to his influence, I'd always wanted to join the army. And I didn't care really sort of what rank, you know, whether I went in as an officer or not. I wanted to get into the army as soon as possible. And, you know, it's partly, I mean, my mother would tell you, and I don't really know, but my mother's passed on, unfortunately, sadly, a couple of years ago. But she would have told you that that was in, partly my sort of keenness, my enthusiasm for the military was couched in the experience of my sort of, I think I told you when we met before, when I was five, my younger brother drowned. Mm. And that's the first visual, sort of vivid visual memory I have. And it was the circumstances of that were that I sort of have always felt that I've always been prepared, no matter what the cost to me, physically or in any other way, to stand between those to whom harm would be done and those who would do it or the circumstances that would do it. Now, of course, life is such that you can't, you know, so go around protecting and saving everybody. But that was a great motivator for me. And I joined the army with that in mind, really. But also my great uncle's experience and sort of stories from, and the way I had huge respect for him from World War One. And so I joined the army. And that I joined the Armoured Corps at the tender age. I signed up at 15 years and 8 months old. My first day in uniform was a little bit later, on the 18th of September 1979, so a little while ago. And I joined the Royal Armoured Corps, the Royal Hussars. I went to Catterick in Yorkshire and then Germany. Tanks were great, but they're big, noisy, dirty, horrible things, really. Once you've done it, you've got that T-shirt and it's time to move on. And I dabbled a bit with the Army Air Corps, passed air crew selection, but decided to go off and do Special Forces stuff, which I sort of partly succeeded in and partly not. I became a Special Forces instructor and then subsequently got posted to Corps headquarters, which the headquarters of all the fighting troops in Western Germany during the Cold War, working on some fairly sort of secret stuff there. And that paved the way to doing all sorts of bizarre things, French Commando course, working with all sorts of other countries and in sort of fairly niche areas of military activity. And then I finally ended up with the deployment, having to go back to my old regiment, being deployed to Central America, get to the point in a minute. And that was jungle warfare stuff, and it was terribly interesting, great experience, huge adventure. But came back to Tidworth in Hampshire, I thought, really? Is this what it's about? And I thought, bored. And so I left, joined the police, but remained in the Territorial Army, and I was commissioned in the Territorial Army, became a company commander, infantry company commander in the Territorial Army. But also went, I was mobilised to go to Bosnia, where I commanded a strategic intelligence unit in Bosnia for the commander of the stabilisation forces in Bosnia. And got involved in something there. There was an attempted coup, which I was partly responsible for detecting, if you like, and being able to sort of respond to before the president out there, Biljana Plavsic, was assassinated, which was the plan, and they were going to take over a city called Banja Luka and da da. This is, you know, people might remember Radovan Karadzic, and there were two other characters.
He was in prison on the Isle of Wight, as I remember.
He was. Right, he's no longer with us. But then I came back. I joined the police, and then the Foreign Office contacted me and said, "Look, we need somebody to go out to Croatia." Balkans experience, military experience, police experience, to go and head up the international police in Croatia, rebuilding the police in Croatia after the Balkan Wars. I was doing that, and then I got a phone call from the Foreign Office, right, 3:30 tomorrow afternoon, British Embassy, Belgrade, go. You are being sent down to Kosovo to monitor the conflict between the Albanians and the Serbs. The small team of us there did that. You know, we were feeding everything back to Washington and to London as to what was going on with the conflict. There was a ceasefire, but only in name. This was the torching of villages and the sort of executions of people and a lot of serious fighting going on down there. And we were in the thick of it as civilian observers, just 36 of us. Interesting times. And but then that's just led on to other things. I was director of international ceasefire operations in the field operations. It was an ambassador heading it, but I was the director of field operations for the international ceasefire monitoring in Macedonia. And I was an advisor to the Albanian prime minister for 6 months. And I ended up as a senior advisor to the OSCE secretary general. And it's pertinent at the moment because we're talking about Ukraine and Russia. Well, we're not, but, you know, the world is, and particularly this week. And the OSCE was established to monitor the rise in tension and try and head off conflict between the 57, as it is, Northern Hemisphere countries, front and centre of the war in Georgia when Russia invaded there, the frozen conflicts and so on. So I was senior advisor to the Secretary General, and I dealt with a lot with Moscow, a lot with Ukraine, a lot with Washington, all the capitals, really senior level diplomatic, security related diplomatic stuff, fascinating. And then left that after 3 years doing that out, and that was where my borders background comes from, partly because I also had the portfolio for assisting those 57 countries of the Northern Hemisphere to secure their borders. Now you're getting my life history here, but you asked for it. But that's, you know, again, you know, I made 13 recommendations to the United States as to how to secure their borders against weapons of mass destruction by terrorists. All 13 adopted by the White House. Those sort of things. Negotiated regional border agreements across Central Asia between the five Central Asian states with Russia, with all sorts. So again, really interesting. And then Afghanistan, 27 months out there, leading a district stabilization team in Northern Helmand. And I also partnered the commander of the United States Marine Corps, in NATO terminology for anybody who knows it. He was one of the lines of operation warfighting. He was the supported commander. I was supporting him as the supporting commander. And the other way around for the other nine lines of operations, governance, policing, counter-narcotics, you know, all these sort of things. So leading on all that. So tremendous experience, 27 months with the US Marine Corps. And came back chief planner for common security and defence policy for the European Union for 3 years. And that's where it all went horribly wrong, because I got in a bar with a whole bunch of UKIP MEPs who led me well astray, which was, but I was also highly Eurosceptic at that point, having been working in the European Union. We can talk about that if you want to. But seeing the waste of money from the member states, seeing some very, very clever and competent people in Brussels, but following their own agenda rather than delivering positive effects for the people of the European Union. And I could see how, contrary to what everybody says, you know, in those diplomatic roles, including that one, I could see so concretely that Britain did not have a louder voice being a member of the European Union. It had far less of a voice. That's the reality. When you have to defer, for the OSCE, you've got 57 ambassadors around the table, all the EU member states had to defer to the statement made by the EU ambassador rather than speak for themselves. And it was the same in Brussels. The UK, I mean, I used to sit regularly in the Political Security Committee of the European Union with all the ambassadors there. And, you know, the UK didn't have a loud voice there, no louder than anybody else, no louder than Malta or Greece or any of these, or Portugal. We were no louder than anybody else. We couldn't be, because it didn't work like that. So outside, the UK, I think, has a tremendous opportunity, if it chooses to exploit it, to take a leadership role. So far, no government has decided to do that. They want to be a lot more collegial. Leadership is an unfashionable word these days. So anyway, I fell in with these disreputable UKIP MEPs who led me well astray. We ended up with a leadership election, as you know, after Nigel stepped down after the referendum. I saw no politician in the country, not Boris Johnson, not Nigel Farage, nobody being prepared to stand up and say, look, and I'd argued for this before the referendum as well, but nobody was saying, listen, this is all about where we want to be 20, 25 years away from it now. This is where we want to be as a nation. We need to have that national conversation. What do we aspire to be at that point in time? How do we want the rest of the world to see us at that point of time? And how do we get there? Because then out of that vision falls everything else. Now, that's strategic sort of kind of thinking, but nobody wanted to go there. Boris Johnson, not Nigel Farage, no, nobody, nobody. I was just told in extremely blunt terms, Henry, that's effing detail, and I don't do detail. Well, okay, you don't, but when you don't do the detail, I know as a military man, you know, and as a strategic and operational planner, if you don't think about the detail, well, you're building in all sorts of weaknesses into your whole plan. And there is no planning going on. And I felt that taking the leadership or going for the leadership, I didn't expect to win it, to be honest, but I saw the people who were lining up for it and I thought, you know, UKIP's in pole position really to be able to introduce that conversation to the national sort of debate about Brexit and the future. We brought about the referendum largely instrumental in its result. We have a responsibility to follow up on that. Mm. Now, the National Executive didn't feel the same way at all. They wanted to go down anti-Islam, anti-immigration. I would say no. Those are important issues, particularly becoming more topical in some respects. But we have to follow another path. We have to start thinking about the future of this country in broader terms and more strategic terms. They absolutely wouldn't go there, so I was at war with them from day one.
Mm. And your leadership of UKIP didn't end up lasting particularly long, at least not by political... By the standards of most political parties. Was it, what, September 2017 you were elected, and then it went, what, 6 months later?
Yeah, less than that, five.
And then a lot of people might know the story. But essentially, the short of it is you were in a relationship with another party member, Joe Marnie, and some miscommunication from the party about your status with your then wife basically ended up sort of tarring your political reputation with your personal life, and it ended very quickly. Do you feel like it's a... You obviously care a lot about politics. You had a very strong vision for what UKIP should be and positioned yourself explicitly against what a lot of people wanted the party to become after it got what it wanted in the Brexit referendum.
Explicitly against where it's actually gone, or where it went.
Because now it is a party of the far right, basically.
And it's actually contributed absolutely nothing since. Mm.
But, the situation with you and your now ex, Joe Marnie, basically scuppered what could have been a long leadership of a political party. Do you regret it for that reason?
I don't know that I regret anything particularly in life. With the knowledge and experience that I went through at that time, I would play things slightly differently. But of course, hindsight's a wonderful thing. What I was just saying about the National Executive set a lot of the context. For that period of time before I met Joe, and whilst I was leader, in fact, during the leadership election, I was being, already being, the whole National Executive, when your whole top team is campaigning against you and doesn't want you to win the leadership and doesn't want you in the leadership position, any excuse for briefing against you to the media, is going to be taken up. So that's part of the context. The other part of the context is that we've talked about my background, probably too lengthily, but that also, I was very well aware with absolute certain knowledge that this was creating waves in other political parties, particularly the Conservative Party, who were going, this CV is quite something and it's going to be difficult to put somebody up to stand against that CV. So there was a great deal of, wanting to exploit any political weakness I showed from that quarter as well, and members of some of the mainstream media, the print media particularly. And so the whole Joe thing, I think what you were referring to was the initial statement that went out from the party, which was, let's say, misleading.
Said that you were split up with your wife when you'd in fact not.
Yeah, exactly. And, it was playing on words that I hadn't seen her since the previous July, which I hadn't because she was living in another country and I was busy doing the politics. But I think that would have been survivable politically. Joe, of course, had, before I met her, sent these messages about Meghan Markle. And that was then, that was transplanted onto me by the media and my political enemies. And I was the racist. I was the guy who'd shown the appalling judgment. And I was, by association, I was guilty. But because of that political cockpit and how nasty and evil it is, really. And, that's politics. I get that. I've looked at politics as they've evolved ever since. Still to this day, no politician, no leading politician has done even tried to do what I was trying to do. Not one. Hmm. And perhaps one could even argue that it's, they're avoiding it so much that built the hostility against me, knowing that that's what I wanted to do.
Something I wanted to ask about, because obviously UKIP technically still exists, but it is a genuine party of right-wing extremism now. It's, insofar as it exists, it's essentially anti-Islam and tries to mirror sort of the European far-right.
Doesn't do it very well either.
No, and they're obviously very jealous of the success of actual European right-wing parties like the National Rally in France. But Nigel Farage left UKIP after the referendum in 2016, and since then he's, had a whole different franchise, the Brexit Party, which is now Reform UK. Mm. And, have recently been polls showing that Reform UK, which is
you know, one way or another, the spiritual successor to UKIP is polling neck and neck with the major parties. I mean, what do you make of their success? Do you think it's an index of how popular they are, or just how much everyone hates the Tories and Labour?
A little bit of both. People want hope. I think this is the main thing. People are, you know, they're desperate. They see absolutely no progress or hope in the Labour Party. They don't, now that they're in government, they don't. The Conservative Party disappointed and disappointed and disappointed again for 14 years. And it's very difficult to lay your sort of faith in the Conservative Party now if you want a positive future for Britain. Not because they deliberately try to undermine it, but I think people just think that they just weren't up to the job or didn't care. I think it's negligence and incompetence, but and lack of courage. But so there's that hope. And where do you put that hope? Well, in something new. And Nigel Farage did deliver Brexit. He is a good rabble-rouser. He's good on the platform. You get all the razzmatazz around it. Great. But that's only hope. I've got a word of caution for reform. And that is that do not think that you've got anything in the bag yet. You probably don't, but don't even think you're on the way, because look at your by-election results since the general election. There have been, what, 190-odd by-election results, local government election results since the general election. They've won, I think, 11.
Two of which were here in Medway, actually, right. As it happens.
So you've got... So that growth in their supporters does not reflect necessarily their electoral results. And you mentioned UKIP and the sort of spiritual sort of successor to UKIP. Sort of. I know what you mean. Absolutely. But UKIP was doing rather well in local government. Better, I would argue, than Reform.
They ran Thanet District Council.
Yes,
for
indeed.
A few years in the 2010s.
Indeed. When I was leader, we were running Thanet.
Yeah.
So I think this is about hope. It's not about commitment to support Reform or vote for it. Reform is still not, in practical terms, a democratic party. I personally feel strongly that if a party doesn't respect the democratic processes within it, can we rely on it to respect democratic processes if it's in power more widely? Mm. That's a concern. I talked about detail and I talked about planning and I talked about strategic acumen. I don't see that coming out of Reform.
Well, the only policy they seem to have that many put forward is basically just sort of, you know, reheated Thatcherism plus, you know, stronger immigration.
Well, is there a vision? I mean, you know, stronger immigration. It's very easy and very popular to tell people what they already know. Immigration's a problem. You know, policing is falling apart. Everything's falling apart in this country. Everything. We all feel that, I think. I do. But it's very easy to tell people that. Where are your solutions? Where's your vision? Where do you want to take the country? And how do you want to get it there? And I don't see the answers to that. Now, that's not to say they won't come, but I do know some of the most senior characters in the party, and they're people who push back very hard against me wanting detail. When I was leader of UKIP. And, you know, I'd get phone calls saying, well, why are you doing this? Well, because we need to build the detail. Oh, no, that's a mistake. So I don't think that those people, you know, Nigel, I don't think Richard, are people who are going to change in that regard. And I think that's a shame. And I hope for that people wake up to that, because otherwise they're going to be disappointed. Here will be another party that starts to... the promises the earth and doesn't deliver. And this is not like Trump. Trump, day one, his 100-odd executive orders are fine. But if you read those are like little mini acts of parliament. Each one is a piece of legislation and repeals other pieces of legislation and so on. He's had teams working, competent teams, to whom he's delegated the task, working on each one of these things. These are experts, people who know how to do these things. And Reform is not doing that. Reform doesn't have that capacity. Reform doesn't have that expertise, hasn't created those teams. And the leadership of Reform doesn't want to delegate these sort of things to such teams, even if they existed. So to think that, to quote Zia Youssef, on day one, a Prime Minister Farage could do X, Y, and Z, That's for the birds. Our system doesn't work like that. Our constitution doesn't work like that. Our legal system doesn't work like that. Our lawmaking system doesn't work like that. You don't have somebody who is both head of state and chief executive, as you do in the presidency of the United States. And you don't have that team doing the detail behind it. Now, I'm not trying to sit here and say, I think, you know, I'm not trying to rubbish reform, but I am sick and tired, like the rest of the country, of getting governments or people in even in opposition who simply aren't competent to do what they do, they say they're going to do. They haven't planned it. They haven't thought it through. That's a problem for me. If a politician is going to stand up and imply or tell the British population that they are going to do X, Y, and Z, then they damn well should have thought through how they're going to do it, where the funds are going to come from, where the resources are coming from, the timelines and the second order, third order effects. You know, even in the immigration thing, which you would think is the keystone of where reform is on its policies, is fundamentally flawed. Mm. It sounds very sexy and attractive. Put the Navy in the Channel, put the Marines in the Channel, push them back to France. You're either highly ignorant of not just our legal and international legal issues, but French legal issues. You are entirely uncaring about the diplomatic and economic fallout. I mean, the French being the French, you do that, you upset them. You're quite likely to have a word with their unions and they'll block the ferries off for a month. How does that affect us? You know, you just haven't thought this through. There are other solutions. You're just trying to grab the sexy headline.
So with the likes of Farage and Tyson, when you say that they're not doing the forward planning, strategic thinking. Is that because they're not capable, or is it they just don't want to get mired in people pulling apart their policies?
I think that latter part is a very big element in it. Of course, if you put forward a solution, there's always going to be somebody saying, well, what about this bit or what about that bit? And I know that Nigel doesn't want to go there because that you get mired in exactly that. You get pulled into the weeds. But at the same time, if you haven't done that work, and you do find yourself in a position to deliver it, either you're going to have a long period of time whilst you're trying to work it all out, disappointment, as per Brexit. I mean, you know, everybody's thing was, you know, the first thing is get out, and then we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Well, we're still crossing that bridge. We still haven't got to it, in my view. And I think a lot of people feel that Brexit delivered independence in law, government and public administration. But we haven't done anything with that. We haven't exploited that to its fullest. And that's because we never had that plan. So that's what happens when you find yourself in a position of doing that and you don't have the plan. So I think, and also, you know, if a politician is scared to have the conversation and the debate about policy because it detracts from whatever else they want to do or whatever they want to focus on, then I think that's, in a sense, it's inefficient and it's undemocratic. Just to explain that, it's inefficient because if you've got people around you who have got expertise and experience and want to offer it, and you say, no, I'm not interested, then you are missing an opportunity to make your policy more watertight, more effective, more financially viable as well, in all sorts of respects. But undemocratic because you're not communicating to people what you're doing. And look at my own view, the Labour government, I mean, a lot of people I know agree, some will disagree, but I think the Labour government made or implied concrete things before they were elected to Parliament, and they have done other things. I fear that that's what, in a different way, we get from reform. We will do this on day one, day one, day one. You know, you won't. I know you won't. And if you're truthful, you know you won't. And therefore, you're not going to do that. You're telling the people one thing. You're going to end up doing something else. And I think that's fundamentally dishonest. And when you're misleading the British public, and I don't care what political party, this isn't just about reform. I've mentioned Labour. Okay. The Conservatives weren't any better. So I think it's both. I think it's detail, it's hassle, it's the difficult bit of politics.
Yeah, sure.
Sometimes getting up on the stage and having a bit of a big party and, you know, it's much more fun.
And it's the show business side of it.
Yeah, and I see the appeal of it.
Lastly, I wanted to ask you, so you're not a fan of reform, even though that's what many people consider to be the, you know, the continuity UKIP. You're not. Many people think you might end up joining the Tories, but you end up finding quite a surprising other political parish, because literally in the past few weeks, you've joined the Social Democratic Party, which traces its origin to a split in the Labour Party in 1981, and now sort of positions itself, you know, essentially, at least rhetorically, basically like Blue Labour, if it was its own political party. Why them of all places? Especially because they're, you know, they have a lot of clout on Twitter, but they're very small.
Indeed. I mean, you know, but reform was small. Brexit Party was small. True. UKIP was small. I mean, you know, I suppose at one point all parties have been small. But I'd also a little bit dispute your sort of labelling of them as rather like sort of blue label, Labour. And I say that because it's like any political party, you will have a spectrum of views and an emphasis, if you like, in people's sort of belief and why they're there. And some people in the SDP have called themselves, and even William, the party leader, has also referred to the party being in many ways quite centre-left. And that worries people, because we have an association that centre-left is, you know, we want open borders, we're, you know, globalists and all the rest of it. So, and that's not the case with the SDP. And actually, when you think about the old school working class, if you go but wind the clock back to the 1930s or, you know, all the way through to probably the 1960s, you know, your shipyard workers, your dockyard workers, your coal miners, you wouldn't find a more patriotic bunch of people on this planet. You know, they were
also a class of people who don't really exist anymore. There's barely any manufacturing in this country.
I agree,
country.
But what I'm trying to say here is that you don't have to be on the right to be patriotic. And where the SDP are, it's an interesting sort of position. It's the only party that I think really holds this position, is that it believes fervently that the government has a role to, if necessary, intervene to ensure that the infrastructure of the nation, energy, railways, are sufficiently regulated, and that might mean having to nationalise them, to empower the, if you like, the capitalist entrepreneurial economy, the private economy that exists, the small businesses, the bigger businesses. Because if you don't have that infrastructure, it's very difficult for them to survive and to trade. So, you know, you can extend, if I've said to people, well, do you think that the police should be heavily regulated by the government? You know, do you think they should be a public body? Well, yeah, of course. What about schools? Well, yeah, I guess. Education? Healthcare? Yeah, well, yeah. And what do you think about the energy companies? What do you think about the French state owning one of our energy companies, EDF? Do you like that? Some people will say, yeah, I'm perfectly happy with it. Most people will probably say, well, I'm a bit uncomfortable with that. What do you think about selling a shipyard to the Spanish when we could have saved it ourselves and it's going to be building our warships? And so it's now a Spanish, you know. And yeah, that's a bit odd. People aren't comfortable with these things. And nor am I, because we are selling the country. We are selling our country, and we are failing to protect some of its assets. There's a company, I think, in the West Midlands, I read the other day. It's the world's leader in hypersonic engines. That's engines that will push something over 3.5 times the speed of sound. Now, it is the world's leader. It's a very small company. It was waiting for contracts, one particularly from British Aerospace, which was delayed because of delays in the defence budget and whether that's going to grow. But they needed that contract to keep themselves going until such time, you know, there were contracts coming through. They needed £20 million to bridge them over. This government decided not to give them that £20 million. We're giving £18 billion to the Chagos Islands, you know, but we're not giving £20 million to our own. So that company went into administration. I don't know what it's today, the state of it is, whether somebody's coming or what. But that's an appalling situation. We're a world leader in something, and instead of engendering that and helping it and to grow and flourish, create jobs, put us in the leading position globally, we're turning our back on it. And I think that's outrageous. And the SDP are very much of that ilk. The government must be empowering a thriving economy by making sure that all that infrastructure, the sort of blood vessels of the cardiovascular system of the country, is functioning properly, so that the rest of the country, the entrepreneurs, the businessmen, the hospitals, the teachers, the policemen, can all do their job effectively and smoothly. And I think that's fundamental. But at the same time, their immigration policies, I think, are far more well thought through and effective, practical, realistic than reforms, far more. Their economic policies are well thought through. You may agree with them or not, but every single part of their policy is justifiable. They've gone into it and they're explaining why they're doing that. They're not just the headline, but there's background to it as well. Now, there is work to be done, and the party's recently appointed somebody to lead further development of policy. And I think that's a good thing. So I like that, both highly patriotic. You know, we should be proud, confident, optimistic Brits. We should feel prosperous and secure here. But the government has a role in making that happen. It's just not down to market forces. And those are the two things. It's not only down to market forces, it's down to government policy. And you've got to put, you know, that British confidence and pride in being British again needs to be rebuilt. And unity. Multiculturalism can very easily be divisive if you don't have an overarching sense of identity and belonging. If you break up the identity of being British, how can disparate people within Britain feel as though they have anything in common, particularly when they've come from foreign cultures? So you've got to recreate that idea of being British, not because it's nationalistic or because it's better than anybody else, but because we all live in these islands together under one constitution, under one monarchy, under one flag, under one government, and we've got to make it work.
Henry Bolton, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
All right, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thank you very much for listening. Please do join us next week where we'll be speaking to another special guest, the MP for Rochester and Stroud, Lauren Edwards. Thanks very much to Sean and Nikki for your contributions. Don't forget to keep an eye on KentOnline.com/politics for all the latest news from across the county. And you can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter written by yours truly by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And also don't miss out on KTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.